Welcome to the Currency.News podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.
Welcome to the Currency Weekend Sports Podcast. I'm Dion Fanning, and we're with Paul Flynn today, and later we're also going to talk to Sean Keyes, because we're talking about Manchester United, and in an age when commercial strength should transform into excellence on the pitch, we want to try and find out why that hasn't been happening for Manchester United. Manchester United this week, Paul, have appointed Erik ten Hag as their new coach. He comes from Ajax, reached the semi-final of the Champions League with Ajax, has had success at the Dutch League, winning the Dutch League a couple of times. But he is still slightly under the radar as a top coach, if you like. Jamie Carragher wrote a piece this week saying that not one of the big clubs in England would swap their manager for Erik ten Hag. I want to talk to you just about this from the point of view of management and what you understand about it, because you've been reading about him and there are certain things about him that impress you and have made an impact.
Yeah, and firstly, I'd say as a Manchester United fan, like, it's probably been the most excited I've been as a Manchester United fan in quite some time, because I've nearly lost the connection that would have been quite strong with the club over the last period. And not because of because of the performance on the pitch, it's because of the manner in which they've been going about things. And just, everyone says that they've lost their identity, but it's so true. You know, I find it very hard to feel connected to the team at the moment. I don't really identify with any of the players that I follow, you know. So this, and previously to this, I've kind of got a bit excited about new appointments and not kind of done a bit of research on it to kind of delve into, is there genuine substance here, or is it just a bit of noise? So this time I decided to, you know, to research ten Hag a little bit more, and what I found has been very impressive. And I think he's a lot of the ingredients that he's a lot of the ingredients that are the solution to many of the issues that we currently face. He's going to come with a vision. I think that's really important, that he comes with a kind of an ambitious plan to bring Manchester United to where he wants to take them, wherever that may be. His meticulous planning has been well kind of commentated on. And his kind of the culture and standards that he's going to bring. And I think them intangibles are critically important at United at the moment, because they seem to be non-existent. So he's got two sides that I think are needed. One is that cultural intangible piece that are going to start bringing a bit of an identity back to Manchester United off the pitch. And the second is a tactical, his whole emphasis is on tactical systems, Dion, which I'm not going to pretend I'm an expert on tactical systems in soccer. But if you just think about it from a sport perspective, like, his emphasis is on tactical systems rather than individuals. So when I bundle all that stuff together, I can't stop myself comparing this guy to Jim Gavin in a certain weird type of way. It seems everything I ever do for the Currency, I seem to be able to wrangle it back to Jim Gavin in some way, shape or form. But there's so many like comparables. Like, I'll never forget Jim Gavin's first day coming in, and his vision was that we're going to win multiple All-Irelands. And, you know, and then he had this plan that was, you know, bringing us into the first 6 months, into the first year of what he was going to do. You know, McLaren has been in the media explaining that's what he did in previous roles. And even listening to, there's plenty of information out there on Ten Hag at the moment in relation to, you know, past players who worked with him, and speaking about kind of some of the standards that he would have implemented on the training grounds. Like, for example, with regards to the kit man, everything had to be laid out in a particular manner, right? That everybody's role had to be at a certain standard. It wasn't just the people on the pitch. And even stuff on the pitch was how he kind of focused so strongly on the basics, Dion. Like, so 5-yard passes, if guys were misplacing them, he'd stop training. And keep on stopping training. And just reminded me so much of things that Jim Gavin would have done. Like, he constantly stopped those things and really sweated over the small details. And that all of them things thrown together, and what we're all seeing viscerally from Manchester United currently, I think they're the ingredients. So yes, while I'm excited, I'm tempering my excitement a little bit because I know of how much of the organizational structural issues that remain, and if they can remedy those, if he can remedy those, he may be a miracle worker. But if he can at least be given the autonomy to remedy the issues that are related to the team, I think there is it warrants being a bit excited, Dion.
Well, that is the key point, though, what you said there about the autonomy, because Paul, like when Jim Gavin was in charge, like we saw towards the end, you know, you see these pictures of the Dublin backroom team and how big they had become and everything. But acquiring that and layering that on, as Jim Gavin did, I'm sure he consulted with people, but I imagine they were his decisions. They were the decisions that he got to make, who was going to be there, what they were going to do, what role was needed. You know, you've interviewed Gary Keegan for the Currency previously, and he talked about, you know, Jim coming to him and the conversation they had and deciding what they could bring. What strikes me about Manchester United right now is that from the reports, everything you, like I've read the great piece in The Athletic about Ten Hag, laid out all this stuff that he's done, but you see the reports this week and the things he's fighting to get would worry me as a manager that these are the things you're fighting to get on your first week in the job. United didn't want Steve McLaren as one of his coaches. Now he seems to have won that battle. I read a report a few weeks ago saying that Ten Hag wanted a say in player recruitment. Now he needs more than a say. He mightn't get the final say. Now it seems to have been agreed that he will have a veto over signings, but also the recruitment committee or whatever they're called will also have a veto. So they've come to an accommodation like that. But again, I don't know what it tells us about. I do know what it tells us about Manchester United today, that those things can still be such an issue for a club that is so failing so spectacularly, that a club that keeps going on and keeps making the same mistakes thinks that there's something in what they're doing that they need to cling to. Now, maybe they think they're getting things better and they're getting things right there, but their recruitment has been appalling. You've only got to look at the performance against Liverpool to see that it's not just a question of desire or all those things, but this is what happens when you bring together players with no clear strategy for what any of them are going to do, because this is how it ends up in this fragmented team. Like, that was an extraordinary performance of surrender, and like it kind of told us a surrender of a whole club, not just the players who are the easy ones to kick around. So when there's these reports that kind of appear all over the place, which suggest that they've been they're part of a kind of collective briefing that, you know, United have concluded was that Ten Hag was the candidate most closely aligned with the club's identity and strategy. And you're like, that's not a good reason to appoint him. The club wants something that actually challenges everything about their identity and strategy, because their identity and strategy was based around Alex Ferguson. And since then, they've had nothing. And they've drifted, and they've talked this talk at different points. And they're talking again now about this being a long-term process, that this is something that will take time. If Ten Hag believes that, he's screwed, because in a year or in 18 months, they'll go looking for a scapegoat again, and the manager is always the most convenient one. So I don't want to, you know, rain on your parade, but I would still be concerned about what's going to happen for United with Ten Hag there.
Yeah, and like, if you think about any kind of, it's easy to say when empires are built, right? You know, when it might be Ferguson's empire or Klopp's currently or Guardiola's, that you look around these individuals and see that everything's going well. So when it was Ferguson, Gill was a great CEO. You know, now Klopp has this great engine around him, same as Guardiola. But you can't take away from the fact that that's what a good manager will do. You know, this, I struggle when I read about the Premiership. You know, he's a head coach, he's not a manager. That annoys me to a certain degree, because if you're a good manager of a football team, you've got a good coaching structure in place, it might be you that's doing it all, right, but you're over it, and you can manage upwards really, really well. You can manage the infrastructure that is a football club. So Klopp is excellent by all accounts at doing this, right? And like, I know there's good engines around it, there's data analytics, there's, you know, all this, you know, the stuff that they say he has. But you take Klopp out there and Liverpool ain't going to be half the team that they were. I don't care what anybody says, you know. Similarly with Guardiola, right? So there's a serious risk associated with, for these clubs, that the managers hold a lot of the power, you know. And you take Klopp out of Liverpool, they're going to lose their identity. You take Guardiola out. So what I'm saying is, Dion, that Ten Hag has to come in and start to own that stuff and manage upwards really well, you know. Try... however he goes about it, like in regards to the Glazers, which seem to be obviously like control freaks, but that element of it has to be managed, that he is able to start to build a new empire. And, you know, yeah, maybe I am being a little bit ambitious that he's going to be able to do that, but I just like everything I read about the guy. He's really astutely thought about his career. You know, I know his background is, he's financially very sound. His family are very wealthy, and he didn't go into a family business that was all centered around real estate. He decided this was the route he was going to go. But as a result of that, he's made very tactical decisions about what he's done to build his own career very intelligently. And I just feel that this guy has a bit more about him than any of the previous ones. He's not just a big name. He's got substance, Dion, you know, and I think we're getting him at the right time. So, yes, look, there's an overzealous excitement for me about this, and I'm not allow you playing devil's advocate reign on my parade. I'm going to continue to be positive about this one and give it the breathing space it needs. But fingers crossed, I'm right.
Sean, Paul touched on a couple of things there to do with Liverpool and you know, what Klopp brings to them, and you know, what Manchester City have got with Pep Guardiola. Now, I would say that Manchester City had titles before Guardiola came along because of the money they have. And they will remain strong. They might not have the same identity as they have with Guardiola, but they will still, because of the financial power of being a petro state, they're still going to have that. Liverpool are a different story. They have been revolutionized by Klopp. But what does that tell us about where Manchester United can go here? Because one of the things that struck me about the conversation last week around the game against Liverpool, and people were saying, you know, Liverpool never surrendered like this in games against United. And that was true to a degree. But also, in those days, when Liverpool were behind Manchester United, they were also commercially, Manchester United were the first club and still seen as the poster boy for how to exploit everything commercially. In the 90s, they got it way ahead of Liverpool. It was Manchester United versus Liverpool United were faded a bit in the 80s, but that was the kind of the great rivalry. But it faded because United accelerated away from them commercially. Liverpool were so far behind. Most famously, I think, the story of when they won the Champions League in Istanbul in 2005, and the club shop was closed the next day because they brought all the staff to Istanbul to watch the Champions League final, which was lovely. It was a beautiful, beautiful gesture, but there was a million people on the streets of Liverpool who couldn't buy any Liverpool merchandise. So United accelerated away there. Where are they now? And like, how are the numbers that are, you know, how do the numbers illustrate how they're underperforming?
Yes, in United's glory days in the Ferguson years, they used to, so as you said, they were commercially on a different level to everybody else. And they combined, so they were able to use that to outbid people, and they had a great squad and they paid their players well. But even when you take that into account, their wage bill was pretty small because the overall organization was so massive. And that's changed now. Under pressure, that's just that advantage that they had has just gradually been eroded year by year, and they're having to pay more and more to just to keep up and to attain their kind of mediocre fourth, fifth, and did they ever go to sixth levels of performance.
But that shows that they're, again, their recruitment is bad because they're paying high wages for players that aren't performing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can see on the recruitment thing, you can see it. You can see it. One way of seeing it is in like the profit they make every year from selling players. And clubs tend to make a profit from buying and selling players every year just because players in general get more valuable. But when you compare the profit United have made from their horse trading and players to what Liverpool has made, that it shows the difference in quality of their recruitment. So over the last 5 years, Liverpool have made 271 million of profit from buying and selling players, whereas United has made 81 million. So yeah, it just goes to show United's recruitment isn't good. But I mean, I think just so back to what you're saying, like it seems to me the big picture is that the two clubs are kind of converging. United from above, Liverpool from below. Liverpool have sort of bootstrapped their way up through just Klopp's brilliance, obviously going deep in the Champions League. They're making way more money from commercial, from broadcasting rights from that. They've made an extra 120 million from broadcasting rights in the last few years, last 4 years. And then at the they've lifted themselves up. United, on the other hand, are dragging themselves down. The level at which they're converging is actually like United aren't really you couldn't call them a basket case financially. They're actually still very strong, but themselves and Liverpool are now kind of at the point where they're both equally strong. There isn't a whole lot between them, and obviously depending on Liverpool maintaining this extraordinary run of performance, but that's where they are at the moment.
And that's pretty impressive from United's perspective that they can still be financially at the level of Liverpool, but they're not performing to anywhere near the same level. They're not going as deep in the Champions League. They're not generating that broadcast revenue income. So it's all centered around merchandise and off-field kind of commercial activity. Is there a risk to that though, long-term? Like do shareholders value, is it looked at in the long to medium to long-term in relation to the number of fans that they're going to be acquiring each year? So for example, all the young kids running around now, I don't see a hell of a lot of them wearing Man United jerseys anymore, you know? So do they place a value on that?
Yeah, like you'd think so, wouldn't you? Like United is one of the few of these clubs that's publicly traded, so you can go and look up the stock price day to day. And so, I used to be when United lost, 9-0 to whoever a couple of years ago. Those sorts of big events, or when they got knocked out the Champions League, I'd be there checking the stock price, and it never seemed to be reflected in it. And looking at their annual accounts, you can sort of see why that is, because the overall figures, like the stuff that's, as long as they're filling the stadiums, as long as they're at least getting into the Champions League, then the stuff that's sort of sensitive to their on-pitch performance is actually relatively small. You know, it's there, like, and I'm sure if they had Klopp, they'd be a more valuable club. They might be making, I don't know, whatever. They might be making 100 million more every year. But that would be like 20% more in revenue. You know what I mean? So that's the thing that you know that story of the great, or was it Woodward's genius of going around to every corner of the planet and coming up with the commercial sponsors for? You'll have the cigarette. Well, I mean, not cigarette sponsor.
The chili sponsors and the hot sauce sponsor, and
they have one for Nigeria yeah. And one for Kenya, and yeah. But anyway, it's that sort of thing.
That is pretty impressive, and that they've been able to do that. But like, they're all probably 10-year agreements, is what I'd be thinking. Like, you know, so that's why maybe that bad performances don't have a kind of an impact on the share price. But the long term, like the next time they come around to renegotiate, like, you know, if there's an impact on the fan base, because that surely is going to have an impact on the reach and so forth, and it's going to have an impact on the next round of negotiations, and that's. Tying back in the whole Ten Hag piece into this, Dion, like, is the whole, he has to be able to kind of work within a very complex system, but you have to be able to create this connection. Him to the management structure, to the organizational management structure, him to the team, and him to the fans. There has to be that kind of connection, and it's completely and utterly obliterated at the moment. There doesn't seem to be a connection between any one of those four key players, because that is going to be important, and that'll definitely have an impact on the finances, in particular in renegotiations with some of them key partners. But like, that's the nature of this job, where it's just that brings the layer of complexity, I think, beyond the jury affair and how to start.
But yeah, I also wonder, like, when you have those kind of figures, what sense of urgency there is about getting it right. Like, now Sean says, if they're not in the Champions League, which again, they might not be in the Champions League next season, as it stands, although the two teams, Arsenal and Spurs, are doing as much as possible most of the time to kind of allow United to get in there if they could. But that is something that maybe would alter things. But, you know, you do have this sense with Manchester United that they the drama of the club, like, is something that they value commercially as well. The idea of it being, you know, Richard Arnold, who took over from Ed Woodward, is the guy who talked about who mentioned what rating their app has on the App Store, you know, this kind of stuff, these metrics, you know, Instagram followers, the number of likes on posts, those kind of things that generate that generate a drama around the club. Now, some of that stuff is is wrong. You know, people talked about the Ronaldo shirt sales, when that's a kind of an urban myth that's something that drove United. But again, bringing Ronaldo back to the club was definitely seen as a wonderful bit of the story of, you know, if you're doing a drive to survive about Manchester United, that's what you want to see happen at the club. But it's not necessarily, it didn't make any sense from a football point of view.
There are maybe some hints that something is going wrong on the commercial side for United. Actually, I'm just looking at the spreadsheet in front of me. So, like, there's three big categories of revenue. There's match day, broadcasting, and commercial. And so United's strength has always been commercial. And so now United and Liverpool are about the same. They've converged at around United have 230 million, Liverpool have 220 million, roughly. Fine. But what's interesting is that United's commercial revenue seemed to drop quite significantly from 2020 to 2021. It dropped by about 50 million. And you might think, oh, that's COVID. But then it's not as though COVID would have stopped people from buying shirts. And secondly, Liverpool's commercial revenue didn't budge. It actually went up in the same period. So maybe this is what you're talking about, Paul. Maybe this is the effect of kids not buying, the brand being weaker, kids not buying shirts, and not rating the app five stars in the App Store.
But again, there is also that, you know, that hostility towards the Glazers, which is, it obviously raises its head when things are going wrong at United. Like, you know, it reaches a point then, but there is an undercurrent, which again doesn't necessarily manifest itself all the time commercially, because it's such a big global enterprise that I think sometimes people forget how little a lot of fans pay attention to that stuff. I remember at Liverpool when they were going through, when they had when the protests were against the previous owners, Hicks and Gillette, and I was covering a game at Anfield once, and I knew friends of mine were coming over from Dublin to go to the game, and there was a big protest planned, and I said to them, are you going to the protest? And they were like, what protest? And it was just a reminder of how little some of these things actually affect the average fan who is caught up in the football. They're not really, but I wonder if there is a point with the Glazers, like you see it with they've now announced plans for a kind of regeneration of Old Trafford, which they've let, the ground itself has decayed. Again, something that was a huge advantage for them over other clubs. They were able to build, they didn't need to build a new stadium. They built up on their old ground. They had so much space around that ground that when Liverpool were fighting to get 3,000 or 4,000 added to their attendance, United were able to just grow and grow and go up, Sean. I like you always like things to happen in planning. They were able to go higher and higher. And Liverpool were behind them. But now, again, they've lost that advantage just because they've left it go and they've let it kind of decay a little bit.
But like the thing though is, at the end of the day, right, they still have, it's still a massive organization and they still aren't paying their players that much, and they're still kind of have their interest payments under control. Like, they're just, United still are kind of, they're kind of a sleeping giant, you know. They have the muscle with the right combination of players, which who they can afford to play, who they can afford to pay, they, you know, they could still do it, they could still be competitive, and they could still, like, yeah, they could still compete with the likes of City for top players.
You mean they're not paying the player they're that much in comparison to their revenue, because their wage bill is pretty high, like, in terms of, they're not matching their wage bill in terms of their league position, where I think they should be in the top four comfortably.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, okay, I'm looking at it as in terms of the wage to turnover ratio,
right,
which is kind of good in that it obviously scales into the size of the business, and maybe it, but in United's case, actually, it might be a little bit flattering because United have more debt than other people. United have this, you know, that's another point actually I was going to raise, that United's debt had been under control, brought back under control up to 2019. But it has since gone up, and next year my rough forecast is that they'll be paying about they'll have to pay about 40 million an extra 30 million pounds in interest payments per year. So anyway, that's a long-winded way of saying that they might not be quite as rich as they seem.
And is there an interesting dynamic here too, Sean? We're talking about, from an organizational point of view, right? They've turned over, you know, 600 to 800 over the last 5 years, in that region, 600 to 800 kind of US dollars. It for a brand, for an entity that's so strong, it's not a massive turnover, like, from an organization point of view in business terms. Like, so that's kind of interesting. So I want to go back to first principles on this. Like, they're bloody football team, they have to, and they're a bloody good one, and they have such a deep history in it that they have to get back to focus in on that, like, and how internally they can't actually get that piece right when it's essentially all they do. I just can't get that, I can't get my head around it. So we can talk, and, you know, we can talk about it in whatever terms you want, that they've, you know, app stores or social media posts or whatever, but they need a leader that's going to come in and say, go back to first principles and get that connection right with all the key stakeholders and get the performances right and consistent on the pitch, and then start to build a new identity and start to forget some of the things that they already know in relation to the history of the identity that they bloody had. I'm sick of hearing about it. I want a new one, a fresh one.
But this is the problem for Manchester United, I think, that if you want, you wouldn't put in charge of appointing a manager to do that for Manchester United, the people who have led Manchester United to the point they're at now. That is the issue. Like, when you read that, you know, Ten Hag, everyone involved in the recruitment process, they were all unanimous in their approval of Ten Hag. To me, that rings an alarm bell. It's like, well, these are the people who've got you into this mess. What are you going to do about like that? Because they've swerved so often. The managers, like, this is a golden age for football managers. Klopp, Guardiola, Pochettino, Conte, and they've sidestepped them all.
Now, Dion, like, you're a football journalist and you've got this completely backwards, right? What made United great was the likes of Ed Woodward and his predecessor and the commercial juggernaut that they built, which financed the wages of Tevez and Ronaldo and Rooney, and made Alex Ferguson look as great as he did. And you know, that's what we've still got. This is the continuity. And I mean, you take the rough with the smooth, but you know what I mean? Let's give them their due.
Well, so what you're saying basically is that Eric Ten Hag is disposable, but Richard Arnold is here to stay.
I'm saying that it's easier to switch managers than to get whatever it is, 3.9 million five-star ratings on the App Store.
All right, lads. Listen, that's really interesting. Thanks for talking today.
You've been listening to the Currency.News podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.